Thank you very much for the introduction. Today I'll talk about anions in an exactly solved model and beyond. And this talk is based on the material of that paper, which appeared in CodeMed, and it will appear in Annals of Physics. And the paper is rather big. It has lots of stuff. And I hope to tell you about this thing, the exact solution of a spin model, and a bit about the next two. But it also has some review material, like a review of algebraic theory of anions. So I will construct an exactly solvable model in two dimensions. This model will have spins on a honeycomb lattice. And it's rare that a two-dimensional model has an exact solution, but this is a lucky example. And in this example, the solution is obtained by reducing the model to a Z2 gauge field, which is coupled to free fermions. I mean, the field is coupled to fermions, but otherwise the fermions are free. And it turns out that this model realizes some of several possible classes of Z2 gauge field coupled to fermions in two dimensions. And there are actually infinitely many classes indexed by an integer nu, but the statistics of Z2 vortices depends on nu mod 16. These are the two main results. And as technical tools, I'll use a definition of Chern number for quasi-diagonal matrices. It's not exactly new. There is a subject called non-commutative geometry, which is much more general, and I'm only using a tiny bit of it, but in an elementary fashion. And there is also a review of algebraic theory of anions, and there are some ramifications like weak symmetry breaking. I'll show you an example of this phenomenon. So, for an introduction, let me explain what anions are. Anions are special particles that only occur in two-dimensional systems. And they have unusual statistics. We know that if we swap two bosons, then nothing happens. But with fermions, we get a minus sign. But if we do the swap twice, which means moving one particle around the other, in both cases, we have the identity transformation. The quantum state doesn't change. And in 3D, this is a general rule, at least for systems with an energy gap. With gapless systems, the phase or the transformation of the vector may depend on the particular path of the particles. But in two dimensions, there is a topological effect. When we move one particle around another, one can obtain a phase vector that only depends on the path topology. And particles with this property are called anions. In the simplest case, the anions are abelian, which means that we just get a phase vector in front of the vector. So if we take a particle A and drag a particle B around it, the quantum state is multiplied by this phase vector. And it depends only on the particle types. I assume that there are several particle types in the system. And such particles exist in fractional quantum Hall effect systems, in fractional quantum Hall systems. Those phases take values 2 pi over 3 and minus 2 pi over 3, depending on the particle charge. There are actually more interesting particles called non-abelian anions. In this case, even if we just place several particles in the plane, will have a degenerate ground state. Actually, it will be a manifold of low energy states with almost the same energy. And this manifold, or a finite dimensional Hilbert space, is defined by L. It depends on the particle types. A1 and A2 are the particle types. And also the particle positions, but the dependence on the positions is kind of trivial. And when we move one particle around another, some unitary operator occurs in this Hilbert space. This is really nice, and this phenomenon can be potentially used for quantum computing. And such particles occur in the nu equals 5/2 state in fractional quantum Hall systems. Now, how do we construct anions? Here is a general idea due to Frank Wilczek. This idea is kind of abstract, but it shows some basic properties of anions. Suppose we have not a Z2 gauge theory, but U1 gauge theory. I'm sorry, Z2 will come later. Suppose we have a U1 gauge theory, and it has magnetic vortices and electric charges. If we move an electric charge around a magnetic vortex, we have an Aronoff-Bohm phase, which means that electric charges and magnetic vortices have non-trivial mutual statistics. The mutual statistics can be pictured by drawing two braids and comparing one to the other. In the first case, the red particle goes around the green one, and this picture is a space-time diagram. The vertical direction is time. And this process is equivalent to doing nothing with this phase vector. So it's just an identity between two operators. And more interestingly, we can construct a composite particle called dyon. It consists of a magnetic vortex and an electric charge. And if we interchange two dyons, we can do several identity transformations. The first identity transformation resolves these crossings, the crossing between two green lines and the crossing between two red lines. We know that vortices and charges are bosons by themselves. Therefore, the crossings can just be removed like this. And the second transformation refers to this property. And finally, we see that swapping two dyons is equivalent to doing nothing with this phase vector. So dyons are particles with non-trivial statistics with respect to themselves. Now, let me switch to Z2 gauge anions, which will be the main subject of my talk. At the abstract level, we just have magnetic vortices and electric charges. We have dyons. In this case, there is only one type of magnetic charge or electric charge, because it's a Z2 gauge theory. And for completeness, we should also add a trivial particle, or no particle at all, the vacuum state. And these four particle types are also called superselection sectors. They do not represent actual particles, but they represent classes of particles that can be transformed one to another locally. So the first two are bosons. This is a fermion, and this is also a boson. And here is the mutual statistics. And the second, the last piece is the set of fusion rules between the super selection sectors. The fusion rules form the abelian group Z2 cross Z2. We have two magnetic states and two electric states. Now, how do we realize such a system? Well, many realizations are possible, and in particular, some of the RVB states in condensed matter physics are realizations of this theory. But let me describe a very simple realization. It's conceptually simple, but it's hard to realize in some material with spins. So we put spins on lattice links, and the value of the spin will indicate the value of the Z2 vector potential of the corresponding, on the corresponding link. And we construct a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian deals with spins. It doesn't have a gauge theory, a gauge symmetry. It's just a spin Hamiltonian, which may be deformed, and it will still preserve some important properties. And the Hamiltonian has terms of two types. One type of terms is associated to vertices, and the other type is associated to plaquettes. And the plaquette term has the product of four sigma z on the link of the plaquette. And this operator B sub P is the intensity of the magnetic field at plaquette P. And we have a minus sign in the Hamiltonian, which forces the system to a state with no magnetic vortices. The ground state will not have magnetic vortices. And similarly, this term measures the charge at site S. It flips the four links simultaneously, and such a flip is exactly the charge operator. And again, the Hamiltonian forces a state where the charge is zero. Therefore, the ground state will have no charges and no vortices, but excited states can carry vortices and charges. Okay. Now, I'm going to formulate some rules we're going to play by. Because when we build a system of spins or electrons, and eventually we want to construct a real material with anions, we cannot assume arbitrary things like a gauge theory or some other symmetry. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sigma z, it has two eigenvalues. One eigenvalue corresponds to one classical state, and the other corresponds to the other classical state of the vector potential. And sigma x changes the vector potential on the link. It's like field fluctuations, which eventually correspond to electric field. So here are the rules. First, we want to consider spins on a lattice, on a two-dimensional lattice. And we'll work with local Hamiltonians. Local means that only neighboring spins interact. In the previous Hamiltonian I showed, the spins interact by groups of four. And this is not very good. It's too complicated. A realistic system. And later on I'll show you a Hamiltonian where spins interact by two. But I want to mention that we define the system in terms of Hamiltonian rather than a Lagrangian, because sometimes a local Lagrangian translates to a non-local Hamiltonian and vice versa. And it is natural to require that the Hamiltonian is local. And two other things. We're interested mostly in gapped phases, not because gapless phases are boring. They're even more interesting, but they may be too complicated. For gapless phases, the statistics of particles is not well defined. Therefore, at least for the purpose of this talk, I'll only consider gapped phases. And finally, no exact symmetry is assumed. Some symmetry may be helpful for an exact solution, but eventually we want to study properties that are robust to generic perturbations. And I'll also talk about gauge symmetries, but gauge symmetries are not built into the system. They are a way of describing the system by introducing some fictitious degrees of freedom. Okay. Now, this is the main subject of this work. This particular spin model on the honeycomb lattice. And in this model, we have spin 1/2 on each lattice side. On each vertex, there is a spin. And there's little labels X, Y, and Z just represent the three possible directions of links. And we'll be constructing a Hamiltonian which involves anisotropic spin interactions. And the anisotropy will depend on the link type. There are three link types. And for each link type, we'll define a term in the Hamiltonian which is Ising-like, but the anisotropy has different directions. For X links, the interaction is like sigma X, sigma X with indices J and K. J and K refer to the lattice sites. And for Y links, we have sigma Y, and correspondingly for Z links, we have sigma Z. And then we put all the terms together into a single Hamiltonian. We introduced three coupling constants, Jx, Jy, and Jz. One interesting phase occurs when all the three coupling constants are equal, but unfortunately this phase is gapless, and one has to introduce some perturbation to the Hamiltonian to open a gap. But this will come later. Now, it's getting a bit technical. Please bear with me for a while. I want to introduce integrals of motion. That is the reason why the model admits an exact solution. It turns out that if we look at a hexagon in the previous model and look at the corresponding labels, you see, this is the hexagon, and six edges stick out, and they all carry some label. And according to those labels, we construct the product of six polymatrices. So six polymatrices associated with six vertices of the hexagon. And it turns out it's just a direct calculation that this iterator commutes with the Hamiltonian. Not only it commutes with the Hamiltonian, it commutes with each individual term in the Hamiltonian. KJK is a term like the interaction along the this link or the interaction along this link, 1/6. And so we have an integral of motion for each hexagon. It's an operator with eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1 because its square is 1. And therefore, as a way to simplify the model, we can first find eigenspaces of those operators. Those integrals of motion commute with each other, and we assign some values to them. Let V sub P be the eigenvalue of the corresponding B operator. And I'll call V sub P the vertex number, because when V sub P, we interpret this fact as no vertex on the hexagon. And when visa p equals minus 1, we say that there is a Z2 vortex on the hexagon. And the Hilbert space splits into subspaces. For each set of vortex numbers, we get a subspace in the Hilbert space, a direct Samand. And we say that a vector belongs to the corresponding space if it satisfies the eigenvalue condition with the corresponding eigenvalue. So now we may say that visa p represents the intensity of the Z2 magnetic field on the plaquette. And we can represent this Z2 field in terms of a vector potential. Nu jk is the vector potential. So we can solve for the vector potential given the magnetic field intensity. It's this solution is not unique, but it is convenient to fix a gauge. And this way we obtain a Z2 gauge symmetry. Now, what do we get out of this set of integrals of motion? Well, let's count the number of degrees of freedom. We get, suppose we have n spins. In the honeycomb lattice, there is one half hexagon per spin. Therefore, when we fix the vortex numbers, we have n over 2 constraints. And the total number of states will be 2 to the n divided by 2 to the n over 2. It's 2 to the n over 2, which is interpreted as having square root of 2 states per spin. This is a finite state. It has a square root of 2 states for each unit. And one can guess that the actual degree of freedom in this system is a Majorana fermion, and Majorana fermions also have this funny number, the square root of 2. And it is indeed the case, and it can be shown by an exact transformation of this model to a fermionic system. And here is just a summary of the Majorana operator formulae. The Majorana operators are operators acting in some space. We'll consider a representation of those operators, of course. And they satisfy these conditions. The second condition is just the defining condition for a Clifford algebra. So Majorana operators are just Clifford algebra generators. But it's also useful to compare this formalism with the creation and annihilation operator formalism for ordinary anions, for ordinary fermions. If we have a fermionic mode with indexed by M, M is the index of the fermionic mode. It is described by one annihilation operator and one creation operator. And we just take the real and the imaginary part of the annihilation operator and call them Majorana operators. And it turns out that the new representation is more symmetric. It satisfies this condition. Now, here is the basic scheme for the solution of the model. We want to solve a model on the honeycomb lattice. And it has spins on the vertices. We replace each spin by four Majorana operators. Four Majorana operators is the same as two ordinary fermionic modes, two boxes. Each box can be empty or occupied, which makes four states overall. So we've introduced some redundancy because spin only has two states, up and down. And we'll deal with this redundancy later. So we're going to replace each spin by a former RNA apparatus. And there is interaction assigned to the links. And each interaction is transformed to a fermionic operator of degree 4. So these four Majorana operators interact, the four operators that lie on the same line. And luckily, these two only enter one term in the Hamiltonian. And therefore, we can consider them together and construct this operator, the product of the corresponding two Majorana operators, BJ alpha and BK alpha. Alpha refers to the direction of the link. And we call this U the Z2 gauge field on the link. It has eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. And this will be the gauge field, and the remaining Majorana apparatus will be the free fermions. And it turns out that we're left with gauge field that only interacts with free fermions. The only interaction is hopping of free fermions controlled by the gauge field. So now let me outline the solution. For each vortex configuration, we can compute the ground state energy for the fermionic subsystem. And I denote this energy as E, which is a function of the vortex numbers. And here is a remarkable fact. The energy achieves its minimum when there are no vortices. It's completely unobvious, but it's a very nice corollary of a theorem proved by Leap in 1994. And before I had learned about the theorem, I did some numerical study, and I formulated this conjecture, and then I saw that Leap proved exactly that fact. Of course, he didn't deal with Majorana fermions. He talked about ordinary fermions, but the result is applicable. And it's a very beautiful theorem. And using this fact, one can construct a phase diagram. The phase diagram is constructed in the space of model parameters. There are four parameters in the model. Three parameters, the three coupling constants. And in principle, we should draw some diagram in three-dimensional space. But it turns out that there is a symmetry that relates positive values of the coupling constant, of each coupling constant, to the corresponding negative value. And also, we can scale the Hamiltonian by a constant factor. So we can imagine in 3D the positive octant, which corresponds to all three coupling constants being positive. And we take a cross section, and we get this triangle. The corners correspond to the cases where one coupling constant is 1 and the other two are zeros. And there are three faces in the phase diagram. The corners are occupied by gapped faces. And those gapped faces carry abelian anions of the same kind I described before, but with some twist. And in the middle, there is a gapless face. And this gapless face doesn't have anions because it's gapless. But when we apply a magnetic field, a gap opens, and the vortices will be non-abelian anions. Now, I'm going to describe the Fermi ionization procedure in more detail. So we are representing a spin by two fermionic modes. The two fermionic modes have a four-dimensional Fock space. Each box can be either empty or occupied. And out of these four states, we'll only use these two. Both boxes are empty or both boxes are occupied with fermions. So we have a physical space, namely the space spanned by these two vectors, and an extended space spanned by all four vectors. And we want to define the physical subspace in the extended space using operator formalism. So we introduce four Majorana operators acting in the four-dimensional Fock space and give them different names. We call one operator C and we draw it in the center of the picture. And the other three will be called Bx, By, and Bz. And this convention fits nicely with the honeycomb lattice. So we can just say that there is a Clifford algebra with four generators acting on a four-dimensional space. And using this representation of the Clifford algebra, we define a subspace. The physical subspace L may be defined using this constraint. The product of the four operators, which represent the total fermionic parity, has eigenvalue 1. So, again, one spin is encoded into four Majoranas. This is the constraint or stabilizer operator in the quantum computing terminology. And the actual spins are represented by these combinations of Majoranas. So we multiply the Majorana in the middle with its partner on the periphery of this picture. And those sigmas are the spin operators, sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. Right, exactly. So we have a constraint, and those operators acting in the extended space. And we need to check that they indeed represent the Pauli matrices. How do we do that? Well, the Pauli matrices satisfy certain algebraic relations. And we need to check all of them. Here is a check for one relation. Sigma x times sigma y times sigma z must be equal to I. Okay, let's do the calculation. We substitute I times bx times c for sigma x. This is the first two factors. Then we add another two factors and yet another two factors. And we simplify the expression. We some cancellation occurs because we move those C's to the right, and the three C's cancel. And we get the stabilizer operator, the constraint operator, on the right, and since it is the constraint, it should be replaced by 1. And we indeed get I. But it's only true subject to the constraint. And now, by a simple generalization, we can do the same thing on all spins of the lattice. We add a subscript j, and we can write than any spin Hamiltonian in terms of Majorana apparatus, subject to this constraint. And I'll call this a gauge constraint because you'll see that it indeed translates to a Z2 gauge condition. Right. It's the condition that there is no charge at this side. So here is the Hamiltonian in terms of spin variables. Remember that this KJK is a product of two polymatrices. Then we replace the polymatrices by the corresponding apparatus in the Majorana formalism. And we get this operator. We actually get the product of four operators, but two of them in the middle, the two Bs in the middle, form a Z2 gauge field. One should be careful about signs because this thing is actually skew-symmetric. But by choosing a suitable convention, one can do all the calculations safely. And eventually we get this Hamiltonian. It's the sum over latest sites AJK times CJ times CK. AJK is the hopping matrix. I put a hat here because it depends on UJK, the gauge field. And in theory, the gauge field is dynamic. But fortunately, for this particular model, the gauge field doesn't fluctuate, which enables us simply to remove the hat and replace this thing by a matrix with numeric values. And the gauge field on each link is an integral of motion of this new Hamiltonian. But it doesn't exist in the spin model because we've extended the Hilbert space and we found new integral of motions in the extended space. And if we want to go back to the physical space, we need to project onto the physical subspace. So, T? It's J. This J. A? The head? Or excuse me.
A, the second place.
This one? Oh, this J. It's the coupling parameter on the corresponding link. And alpha refers to the link direction. In general, yes. At least I have three different couplings because there are three directions of links. Well, in principle, I can adjust the strength of each coupling individually, but I'll not consider this general model. Yeah, I could. Yeah, it is still solvable. Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, and here is the prescription for solving the model. First of all, I want to mention that the old integrals of motion are still there. They are just the magnetic field intensities of the on the placket. And to solve the model, we need to do these steps. We choose a vortex configuration, then we fix a gauge, then we obtain a quadratic Hamiltonian. It's quadratic in terms of the fermionic apparatus. We find the ground state energy, and it will depend on the vortex configuration. And of course, we want to choose the vortex configuration so that the ground state energy is minimal. And this will give us a solution for the ground state energy. If we want to write down the ground state itself, we still need to project onto the physical subspace, which means symmetrizing over all possible gauge transformations. And each gauge, there is a gauge transformation on each vertex. And we symmetrize or project onto the eigenvalue 1. And this procedure keeps the vertices fixed. Okay, so that was the general scheme of the solution. I'll show you the results later. Now I want to discuss quadratic fermionic Hamiltonians. Of course, you know that solving a quadratic Hamiltonian is easy. Now, I want to give a simple mathematical reason why it is easy. Let's write down a quadratic Hamiltonian in terms of Majorana apparatus. And AJK is a real skew-symmetric matrix. And CJ are Majorana apparatus. And they act in the Fock space. Remember that there are two n such apparatus, but the Fock space has dimension 2 to the n. Now, this is the basic fact. When we commute two quadratic Hamiltonians that are defined with matrices A and B, and I used that notation, H of A on the top. When we commute two apparatus like that, we get an apparatus of the same kind, but here we have a commutator of the matrix. So we have a map from the Lie algebra of skew-symmetric matrices, and this is SO of 2n, to the space of apparatus acting on this exponential large space. And if we want to do some calculations, it can easily be done in this small space. And then we'll lift it to the large space. That's how the exact solution works. For example, we can find the one particle spectrum following this procedure. If we have this Hamiltonian, then only working with it, matrices 2n by 2n, we can construct linear combinations of Majorana modes so that the matrix A assumes a canonical form. It's block diagonals with blocks 2 by 2. And here is the canonical form. We have normal modes coupled this way. B prime M is coupled to B double prime M. We say that those modes are paired, and this is a kind of fermionic pairing, but it's a different use of term pairing as compared to superconductors. And one can also introduce annihilation or creation apparatus if it's more convenient for the solution, but it's not necessary. The ground state can be described in terms of the normal mode, and the ground state energy is this. And if we have translational invariance, we can further simplify the problem. We can compute the spectrum epsilon of Q, where Q is the momentum, and this way we get an exact solution. Okay. I'll not do any real calculation, but let me make this observation. It's quite general observation. Let's consider this matrix that defines the canonical form of a quadratic operator. We have Majorana modes paired. The first mode is paired to the second, the third is paired to mode number four, and so on. And the coupling strength is epsilon j for each pair of modes. It turns out that this coupling defines the same ground state as the coupling with coupling strength 1. So for the purpose of finding the ground state, not the ground state energy, not the spectrum, but the ground state itself, we can replace all the eigenvalues of the matrix A by 1s. And similarly, if we have a general matrix which is of this form, it's basically a rotated canonical matrix. We can replace each eigenvalue by plus one or minus one using the same rotation. And symbolically, this is written like that. We apply the sine function to this matrix which is Hermitian. And there is a function formalism for Hermitian operators. And the resulting matrix has very nice properties. I call it the structural matrix of the fermionic system. It's real, it's Q-symmetric, and these properties are obvious because we work in the same class of matrices. It also has this nice property, B squared equals minus 1, and B is quasi-diagonal. Well, it's not always the case. I mean, this condition and that condition are only true if the system is has an energy gap. And quasi-diagonal means that the matrix elements on the lattice decay fast enough as a function of the distance between J and K. As the distance increases, we have exponential decay of the matrix elements. And one can define a so-called spectral Chern number. I call it spectral, but it doesn't actually depend on the spectrum. It depends on the structural matrix. And it's defined like this. We project onto negative energy states of the structural matrix by constructing this projection operator. And after that, we have a projection matrix whose rows and columns are indexed by lattice sites. We have a matrix on a lattice, so to speak. And this matrix is quasi-diagonal, meaning that the matrix elements decay fast enough as the two sides go far apart. And such matrices have a topological number called the Chern number. It can be defined in many different ways. And the traditional approach, which turns out to be not quite sufficient for my purposes, is this. We assume that the matrix has translational invariance, meaning that if we move both indices, J and K, by the same amount, we get the same matrix element. And here is a picture. The honeycomb lattice has a lattice unit cell with two sides, and we move this unit cell to another unit cell, and we get the same matrix element in the unit cell. If we have a translationally invariant matrix, we can do the Fourier transform, and the Fourier transform will be a projection, which is a 2x2 matrix, depending on the momentum Q. Q belongs to the torus. The Fourier domain of a lattice is a torus. And it's a 2x2 matrix because there are two sides per unit cell. And when we have a projection, depending on parameters, we can define the corresponding subspace it projects onto. We get a subspace depending on parameters. And a subspace depending on parameters forms a vector bundle. It's a one-dimensional complex vector bundle, and it has an associated Chern number. And it turns out that this Chern number defines everything in the model. But unfortunately, we have to consider the situation where the translational symmetry is broken by vortices, because in the end we want to study vortices. And there are two ways to approach this problem. The first way is non-commutative geometry. It's pretty difficult. But there is also an elementary approach. We can divide the lattice into three domains, and we construct this sum. Pjk is the matrix element of the projection. And this is a cyclic combination of three matrix elements. And we require that J belongs to this region, K belongs to that region, and L belongs to that region. And we consider a sum over all triples of sides belonging to their respective regions. And miraculously, this is an integer. Of course, it's an integer when P is a projection matrix and it has fast decay of coefficients. So it must be quasi-diagonal. Now, well, because I'm taking a sum over J, K, basically it's, excuse me? Pjk is a matrix element. It's a number. Excuse me? Yeah, exactly. It's a cyclic Hall cycle. Right. I assume it's rather simple stuff, but it allows some nice generalization to real matrices where we get kind of analogs of real K theory. I'm not quite sure how to make this analogy exact, and I would be happy if some mathematicians in the audience will refer me to the corresponding literature. But right now I'm working with a complex matrix. Okay. This expression is used in the presence of vortices because we cannot rely on the Fourier transform. And it turns out that when nu, this number, is odd, one cannot actually define the structural matrix in the presence of vortices. Well, what I mean is this. Let me show you the conditions for the structural matrix. These properties are automatic, sort of automatic. These two are non-trivial properties. And one of them must be broken. But those properties rely on the existence of the energy gap.
In the presence of vortex, It's not possible. There is a topological abstraction for constructing such an object.
Basically, this condition is broken in the presence of vortex, which means that vortices carry unpaired Majorana modes or zero modes. Each vortex carries a zero mode, which makes it a non-abelian anion. And it's even more interesting that there is a 16-fold periodicity. The so-called topological spin of the vortex, which is obtained by twisting the vortex by 660 degrees, is given by nu over 16. There is a 16-fold periodicity in the properties of vortices. And one can describe all the 16 phases that appear in this model. But in the original model, only three of them are relevant. The nu equals zero phase occurs in the corners of the phase diagram. We have the superselection sectors we've seen before, but there is a little twist. Magnetic vortices, there are two types of vortices. One type of vortices leaps on odd rows of hexagon, and the other types lives on the other rows. There is an alternating pattern. Physically, there is one cannot tell a difference between E and M. The only way to tell a difference is to try to change M to E. And if one had sufficient experimental capabilities, one could see that it is impossible. When one tries to move M to E, M to this hexagon, one has to create or absorb a fermion. And this kind of phenomenon is called weak symmetry breaking. I call it weak symmetry breaking in dimension 1, meaning that weak symmetry breaking in dimension 0 is just the usual symmetry breaking, order parameter. This is symmetry breaking in dimension 1, and one can also define symmetry breaking in dimension 2. And a number of phases studied by Wen fall into this category. But one can try to speculate beyond dimension 2. And I don't know whether it's exact, but it seems that one can even define symmetry breaking in dimension 4, which is Chern-Simon section. If a theory has Chern-Simon section, it's sort of symmetry breaking in dimension 4. But mathematically, I can only go up to dimension 2. I mean, one can make a precise description and correspondence to a classifying space that has non-trivial homotopy groups in dimension 1 and 2. Okay. Now, in conclusion, let me I'm close to finishing my talk. This is the gapless phase. It corresponds to nu equals plus and minus 1. It's obtained by adding this term to the original Hamiltonian. This is the magnetic field. And this term, this Hamiltonian is not solved exactly, but using the third order perturbation theory, one can replace this term by that term with free spin interactions. And this thing can be solved exactly. Again, we get a quadratic fermionic Hamiltonian with the spectral Chern number plus 1 or minus 1, depending on the signs of the magnetic field projections. And now, excitations are non-abelian anions. They have the same fusion rules as fields in the Eisen CFT, in the Eisen model, these are the fusion rules. And the last fusion rule is non-abelian. If we fuse two sigmas, we either get one, which means complete annihilation, or we get an epsilon. So two sigmas may fuse into an epsilon or may annihilate completely. And we don't know what's going to happen until we actually fuse them. When we keep them far apart, these two states are almost indistinguishable. They have the same energy and other physical characteristics. And one can hope to build a quantum memory or maybe even a quantum computer using this phenomenon. So, yeah, that's true. So, here are some speculations about anionic quantum computer in the honeycomb lattice. To initialize, basically, the same operations apply to other anionic systems with some modifications. To initialize a qubit, we need to create a particle, antiparticle pair. In this case, it's a pair of two sigmas, because sigma is an antiparticle to itself. To measure a qubit, we need to fuse two particles, and we get either epsilon or 1, 0, 1 outcome. And to perform a unitary gate, we need to braid the particles, and the braiding is described by some phase factors. Unfortunately, the braiding gate is not universal for this particular model, but one can get around this factor using some other gate implementations that are not exactly topological. I mean, this implementation is nice because the only thing you do is drag in particles. If you do something more complicated, you could get other gates, but they will not be precise. Yeah, this is not enough to construct a computer. So, yeah. And finally, I want to show you a gadget which may be called an anionic qubit. It has four anions per qubit. And the number four comes about because when we only have two particles, there's one and epsilon belong to different superselection sectors, and they cannot form coherent superpositions. Here, we have four particles whose total superselection charge is trivial, and one can construct 0 and 1 initializing this qubit in two different ways. The logical 0 is done by creating two pairs from the vacuum. And the logical one is constructed by creating an epsilon-epsilon pair first and then splitting each epsilon into two vortices. And here is a thought experiment that would verify the properties of anions. We can create two pairs this way and annihilate them in a different way. And with probability, we get nothing. With probability 1/2, we get nothing. And with probability 1/2, we get two epsilons. And this will be an experimental test. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for your attention. I haven't checked it in the sense that I don't know the phase boundary, but I'm certain about the stability of this phase of this model to weak perturbations. Yeah, because of the gap, exactly.